Hey everybody, Glenn Thrush with Politico's Off Message Podcast, History Edition. I'm not supposed to say this, apparently. This isn't a cool thing to bring up. But seeing as I sat through Hillary Clinton's historic glass ceiling speech 8 years ago, I think it's important for us to take this moment in time and recognize the fact that Hillary Clinton, whether or not Bernie Sanders wants to recognize it right now or not, he will, is the first female nominee of a major party in this country's 240-year history. That ain't nothing, I am telling you. I was raised by a mother who was interested in politics and was always telling me that she never thought that there would be a female president in her lifetime. That turned out to be true. Fortunately, we're at least having a nominee in her son's lifetime. That is a big deal in this country. It's a big deal to women. It should be a big deal to everybody else. You know, I tweeted this thing out a couple of days ago. I got a lot of positive response to it. But I also got a lot of people saying stupid crap, like gender doesn't matter. The only thing that's really important is a candidate's ideas. Well, you want to know something? Gender does matter. And if the only thing that was important was a candidate's ideas, how come we've had 44 presidents and none of them have been women? How come we've never had a major party nominee who is a woman? I think it's time for us just to recognize this is a big deal. We're breaking through a barrier. 75 or 80 nations in this world have had female leaders. I'm not commenting on whether or not Hillary Clinton ought to be president, whether or not she'll ultimately get indicted on the email thing, whether or not Donald Trump would be a better president. I don't care about that crap. I'm just saying, good for us to have a female nominee for the first time 100 years after we first gave women the vote. Our guest today is Joe Scarborough, Morning Joe, former Republican congressman from Florida. I've sparred with him from time to time on Twitter, as I have with just about everybody, including my family. A lot of times early on in this campaign, I thought Scarborough was a little too close to Donald Trump. Trump is a longtime friend of his. They've played golf together. And I thought that Scarborough, frankly, was one of those people early on who was giving Trump a free pass, along with some other folks in the media. I was really surprised by my conversation with Scarborough. He's had a real up and down relationship with Trump. And the thing that I found really cool was when I asked him about this, he confronted it head on. And he said something to me that not a lot of famous people ever admit. He said, "Donald Trump is my friend, but what the hell does being Donald Trump's friend really mean?" And that's really important. You know, public friendships are not the same thing as private friendships. And Scarborough, subsequent to the taping of this last week, has gone to war with Trump. You get a taste of that in our conversation about him souring on Trump. But what I found really interesting was talking with Scarborough less about his life in the media and just more about his ongoing relationship with Trump, which goes back years and years and years. One of the really fascinating things, and I'm not going to give it away here in the introduction that he says, is he talks about Trump's relationship with a rival cable titan, CNN's Jeff Zucker. And Scarborough has some unflattering things to say that I think are going to make a little bit of news. But in general, I was just struck by how open he was about this. I think his current feud with Trump is entirely authentic. He recently criticized Trump, called Trump out as a racist. You know, I like to pretend that I'm allergic to these charms, but Joe Scarborough is a genuinely charming dude, and I was charmed. So the usual bit of business, follow us on iTunes and rate us. We're getting really good ratings. God knows why, but we are. Keep sending me emails at gthrush@politico.com. I've been getting a lot of really good, suggestions for guests. A bunch of you suggested we do Gary Johnson, Libertarian candidate. I think that worked out well. We ran him on Monday. This one is a midweek special, just because we had an embarrassment of riches. Without further ado, here's Joe Scarborough. The pictures I've seen of you and your band, it looks like you have is that an actual Gibson ES-335?
It is.
What year?
Jeez, I don't. You know what? I got it for as a birthday present last year, so I'm not sure what year, but I got it down where I get all my guitars, which down is 30th Street Guitar from a guy named Matt, who knows his guitars and is actually a Morning Joe fan. I thought it was.
What other guitars you got?
A little bit of everything. I'm a huge Tele fan, so
I just got one.
Oh, did you?
Yep.
I have. It sounds vintage now, but it's very depressing. I have a 1982 Tele, which I bought in 1982, which is sort of has been my main guitar since then. But you know, I have about three or four different Teles, all different sort of different years. I also play bass, and I've started kind of buying probably about one a year jazz bass.
So you have like a Fender Precision. You have
Have a nice. Precision, and nice. I always played the Precision, but then for some reason I was in a studio up in Boston a couple of years ago, and I never played the jazz, and I was like, wait a second,
it's a different feel.
It is a lot easier to play. The frets are a little closer together, yep. And you can move a lot more. So
it's a more guitarish kind of bass.
It is. So when I'm recording, that's what I do. I mean, it's a jazz. I'll use a jazz for my bass, and I'll use Tele for most things that I record.
You're not a Les Paul guy, though.
Not a Les Paul guy. I love playing the Les, and grew up played Les a lot. I will say live, it was like carrying around a chunk of cement for 4 hours. But yeah, the sound's incredible, and of course I always love playing it. It's just like a Strat. I always love when I get my hands on a Strat.
Tele's a heavy guitar, man.
But I've always gravitated towards the Tele over the Strat, and always again, if I do something that I really want a heavy chunky sound, I'll get a Les and play a Les Paul. But usually I just like that very Americana, you know, Tele. There I've got a 1965. Fender Blackface.
That's really nice.
And it's just a great, clean, sweet American sound.
It's warm, and it's got that trim. It's got the great reverb on those.
Yeah.
Those old Fender amps.
Yeah, it does.
So let's talk a little bit about, you had a flirtation earlier in the cycle with potentially thinking about running yourself. How serious was that?
Never serious. I mean, the thing is, people, I mean, since I've been out of Congress, people have come and talked to me, and I can tick through the years 4 or 6, you know, and 10 and 12, it was always something different. But you know, I always have to get past the first obstacle, which is I've got a day job, mm-hmm. pays me well, it pays for my mortgage,
right?
And until I'm done doing this, which is 18, I don't think I have the freedom to go out, don't have the money to go out and just stop working. I'm not Donald Trump or Mitt Romney.
Would you have found enticing in terms of being able to appeal to the electorate this year? I mean, like, what virtues do you think you would have brought to a race?
It depends. Are you talking about as a Republican or as an independent?
Dealer's choice, baby.
Well, I think as a Republican, what people don't understand about politics is it's so visceral. And I learned this early on the first time I ran in 94. I would just walk into a room. And if it was a room of Southern Baptists, which most of my voters right. were in the Deep South, I always joke, you know, I could be wearing a coat and tie, you know, Brooks Brothers, dark blue coat and tie, a white starched shirt and a red tie. I walk in and I look around and it's kind of like the Taliban. Like, you know who's who. I know a guy that's grown up in the Southern Baptist Church. I don't care what he's wearing. I don't care what he's saying. You know, it's just right. culturally you're connected. And so I think so much of politics has to do with personality and that sort of connection. And I think none of these guys could take on Trump because they just couldn't connect. Marco Rubio, he's just far too calculated. I always said in every speech I heard from Marco Rubio, I heard the echoes of 1,000 focus groups.
Right.
Ted Cruz, I forget who said it. I think it might have been, who said it on our show? Somebody said it on our show that even the defending of his wife, when his wife had been insulted, sounded like it had been a calculated, planned out speech. None of these guys knew how to get at Trump at a gut level.
Okay.
George W. Bush, a guy that I had a lot of problems with politically and who had limited political skills in some areas, George W. Bush would have cut Donald Trump to shreds with a single look.
Well, let's go to an insane hypothetical, because that's, yeah. You know, you do that. I'll do it to you.
That's my job.
That's your job. How does a Joe Scarborough, who's got that visceral connection with those Southern Baptists, how would you have run a race if you were on that first or second debate stage with Trump? How the hell would you have dealt with that?
I think you just go to him. He's a bully. And you don't let bullies bully people. You just mock him endlessly. The one thing Donald Trump can't stand is people calling him out. And instead of becoming indignant about it, laugh at him. Which he hates. Like, oh, really? Really, Donald? You gave, you know, so much. Yeah. And just whatever claim he makes. And you could make it on foreign policy. You could make it on domestic policy. You mock him. You ridicule
him. What is his
weak?
Okay, you know the guy. You've been out to Mar-a-Lago. What is his weak? If you were to look at his psychic weakest spot, what is that?
You were talking about
Star Wars, the Death Star thing.
He is insecure. He is a guy that is a Queens guy. And as Graydon Carter says, he's from the outer boroughs. That's always driven him, I'll say it, batshit crazy.
You know, you're talking to Brooklyn here.
Yeah.
And Brooklyn looks, of course, rightfully looks down on Queens.
Right. So he's an outer boroughs guy. If he were from Brooklyn, that would be hip now.
Right.
But he's still a Queens guy that, you know, he's kind of like Rush Limbaugh and Bill O'Reilly, two guys that always thought that their success would be their gateway into the club. And they would be respected in Manhattan, and they would be the toast of the town. And everybody would say, you were right, and we were wrong, and we were... Instead, they're still kind of treated like they're dirty in polite society in Manhattan. And it drives them crazy. It fuels their anger. It fuels their rage.
So he builds his own club.
So Donald Trump comes in and in his mind takes over Manhattan's real estate market and gives money to all the right charities and all the right events. And he's still not allowed in the club. So he uses that resentment, unlike others, as a fuel, a very successful fuel.
And it resonates with a huge number of people who also feel entirely excluded.
Exactly.
Andrew Jackson wasn't part of the club.
Right. And that's actually Trump's strength. People are always like, why are people in Toledo relating this to this guy?
Right.
Because it's like I said before, like when I walk into a Southern Baptist church, I could be anywhere in the world. I could be like smoking pot when I'm going down like the center aisle. Doesn't matter. People still know I'm one of them instinctively.
Right.
That's politics. Trump, they don't know why he's resentful. He's got $1 billion. He's got an attractive, you know, supermodel wife. He's got Trump Towers. But they can just tell there's an edge to this guy. He's angry. He's not in the club he wants to be in. And that's why they relate to him.
But you feel you could have interrupted that.
I'm not saying I could do that. You're asking how would I do that. That's like asking, you know, it's like asking a fat 53-year-old commentator, hey, so how do you stop Tom Brady? John Madden can say this is how you stop Tom Brady.
But can
John Madden stop Tom Brady? Probably not. But if you were a candidate that could go out there, and if you were looking for Trump's weakness, it's his insecurity. There are things that drive him absolutely crazy.
Give me one specific thing you think would drive him over the edge.
Well, ratings, numbers, saying that Bernie Sanders draws more people than him, mocking him for only having 5,000 people at the rally when he thought he was going to have 400,000.
That was something.
It was grating on him. It's never enough. Like after Iowa, I remember talking to him on the phone going, Donald, it's just one contest. You're ahead in 49 states. You know, he would even leading into Iowa. He was ahead in polls in 49 states, but down one. So he went and started calling people in Iowa stupid.
Does he get down, do you think? Do you think he bottoms out?
I don't think he bottoms out. I mean, I've known him for 10, 11, 12 years. And, you know, we're friends, but he's, you know, I think currently he's angry with me. You know, he'll call me once every 3 weeks. Joe, you're a good guy. And I'll be like, yeah, for now.
Right.
This second.
Right.
And I was having a conversation with a couple weeks ago. Donald, please. I'm your buddy today because I must have said something you like. Tomorrow, I'll be your sworn enemy and you'll tell me you'll never watch Morning Joe again, which I think he's in the current. I'm never going to watch Morning Joe again. But, you know, he always does. But I don't know that he gets down. I do think, again, like Limbaugh and like O'Reilly in their day, when they had first come to, you know, national prominence, I do think that sometimes he thinks, what do I got to do? What do I have to do to get these people to respect me? But again, I think, unlike a lot of people, Trump turns that anger and that resentment into a powerful fuel that's actually got him doing something that he didn't even think he was going to do. He never thought he was going to win the nomination.
Did he say that to you early on, that he didn't think it was a lark?
You know what? At some point, I think it was in December, he did call me. He goes, can you believe this? I can't believe this. Can you believe how well things are going? And I said, no, I really can't.
Well, let me ask you something. You got into some hot water with this sit-down you did with the Y a few months ago, where you were talking about having private conversations with him.
Yeah.
One of the things I thought was really interesting is you said to him, read a goddamn briefing sheet occasionally, yeah, right?
I still say that.
Let me ask you, though. You are somebody, you know, you're a public person. We talk about you playing guitar,
right,
and stuff, but
right,
you were a well-briefed member of Congress, and
right,
you read your paper every day.
Right.
Do you think this guy is qualified, educated, informed enough to be president of the United States?
I think he is intelligent enough to be president of the United States. I think, like Rudy Giuliani, he's one of the fastest learners that any of us have met. He walks into a room, he reads a room, he knows exactly where to go. He is like Rain Man on that front. Where
drop a bottle of pennies.
Yeah, exactly. No, but I mean, I mean, people said that to Ken Melman. They called Ken Melman Rain Man. I mean, it's a very positive thing. He can do things that most politicians could never dream of doing. I do think, though, that his limitation is a lot of is the same thing that limits a lot of politicians. And that is, they look at what's worked for them in the past. So what's worked for Donald Trump in the past? Saying, Trump steaks are the greatest steaks ever. I don't know if you know it or not, but last quarter, more people ate Trump steaks than any other steak on the planet. Trump water. Do you know that this is the most natural, pure water in the world?
Trump it air.
Trump water is actually taken from the brooks of the Swiss Alps by Nordic elves, who actually bring it down on sleds. I mean, and he will say it enough that he believes it. And that's what's worked for him, and it's wanting the damn nomination, right? So what concerns me is
that self-deception?
But see, that's the thing about Trump.
Yeah.
It's not, you know, Dizzy Dean, I love the quote of Dizzy Dean, it ain't bragging if you can do it.
Of course, he blew out his arm.
Still, he's Dizzy Dean, he's in the Hall of Fame.
Sorry, man.
But with Trump, it's not self-delusion if at the end of the day you win the Republican nomination and you've done something that nobody in America believes you'd ever done, and he's made political history by doing it. To me, I think, and maybe he proves me wrong, like he proved everybody wrong in the first round, I don't think you win a general election that way. I'm a big believer. Demographics is destiny. I'm a big believer that what Ken Melman learned in 04, what Obama did in 08, what Obama did in 12, it's how you win general elections. You find your people, you target your people, you drag them out. And that's something that Trump's not doing.
And he has no infrastructure.
He has no infrastructure. I have no idea how he can win. I don't think there are enough white men to elect Donald Trump president. I could be wrong, but if I am, then it totally changes the calculus of American politics, at least for the next decade or so.
Now you've taken a fair amount of shit for being close to him, and there's been this back and forth you mentioned about kind of these periods where you were pretty friendly with him and the periods
right,
where you've had some smacky face.
Yeah.
You did call him a friend. He is a friend of yours.
He's a friend, yeah.
And he made a boo-boo and said you were a supporter,
He also said that to David Axelrod. David, thank you for supporting me. He was so excited. Anytime anybody said anything nice about him, you know, he would assume that they're supporters. But again, that's Donald, too. I mean, he's just like, he will call you a supporter whether you are or not.
Would you, in a Hillary matchup, and it's going to be a Hillary matchup, okay,
right,
the Sanders stuff. See, I watch your show.
Right.
The one thing I will tell you is I will go down with this. History will show that the Democratic race effectively ended on March 15th.
Yeah.
You know? But right, when it's Hillary versus him and you're in that voting booth, is it going to be a difficult decision?
Well, it depends. I want to see who the third person is. And I've been really clear.
Yeah.
I was clear in 2012. I voted for Ron Paul as a protest vote. In 16, I've been very clear, and I said it when he started talking about the Muslim ban. I said, I will never vote for any candidate that talks about banning $1.4 billion people from entering the United States because of their faith.
Yeah.
Said it was disqualifying. I said what he said about David Duke was disqualifying. So if Donald Trump backs off of the Muslim ban and actually puts a policy out in place that I feel confident that he is, he actually takes that back and takes back some of the other things that he said, then maybe I could even consider it. What I'm telling you right now is I can't even consider voting for Donald Trump right now because he has, because the Muslim ban is still in place.
Would you ever consider voting for Hillary Clinton?
Well, yeah. I mean, I'd consider voting for Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton.
So she's not ruled her out.
I haven't ruled her out. I mean, for me, what scares me with Hillary is the Supreme Court. I mean, I'm a conservative guy. I'm worried about three Supreme Court justice nominees that could change the balance of the Supreme Court for the next generation. So I don't rule voting any of them out. I do find it hard to believe, though, that I would be voting for Hillary Clinton. You talk about, in the voting booth, I look down, can I see myself voting for Hillary Clinton? Probably not. Donald Trump, there's a chance, but—
Mitt Romney?
Yeah.
As the third.
Yeah, I'd vote for Mitt Romney.
You'd take him in a heartbeat over the—
You know, time. I said all along, I wanted Jeb to win. Yeah. Again, pretty open. I've said from the beginning, I thought Jeb was the best public servant I've ever seen at work, and then I moved my support to John Kasich. If Mitt Romney ran, I would. I don't have to even think twice.
The thing about Jeb is I interviewed him on his campaign bus when things were going down in New Hampshire, and the thing that really struck me is he was impatient with the process of campaigning, wanted to get his hands on the levers of government. He's a dude who wants to govern.
The guy was the best governor I've ever seen in my life. I've been around a lot of politicians over the past 25 years up close. There just wasn't a close second. His cabinet members in Florida were horrified every time they went to a cabinet meeting because they knew no matter how much they briefed, their boss was going to be smarter than them.
And a scouring pad kind of intellect.
Yeah, he just is a brilliant guy, but you know what? He could never figure out a way to translate it on the campaign trail.
So in terms of Trump, now you said you've known him for a dozen or so years. This balancing act of somebody who is a friend, somebody you deal with offline.
Yeah, but I'm a friend. I mean, that's the thing. I'm a friend. Find somebody I'm not friends with, actually, in politics. Like the Obama administration, I've spent more time talking to Valerie Jarrett than I ever spent talking to any Republican that was in the White House. We go out and eat with her all the time. Friends with tons of people in the House. I'm close friends with Chris Christie. We're close friends with, you know, Claire McCaskill. So, let me explain that really quickly about Trump.
Yeah.
I consider myself a friend of Trump's. When I was sort of hedging, Mika said, come on, you're his friend.
Yeah.
I am his friend. But to be Donald Trump's friend is to be like, is to be somebody that says hello in short bursts. He's walking through. Hey, Joe, thank you so much for being here. Isn't this the most beautiful place you've ever seen? You are great. I love you. You're wonderful. Thank you, Donald. Great to see you. But
you don't feel that. You feel it's a pretty superficial friendship.
Well, no. I think that is a friendship in Donald Trump's mind. But I will tell you, I've never sat down and had dinner with a guy.
Right.
I've never sat down. I don't think I've ever sat down and had lunch with a guy. I've had longer conversations with Barack Obama one-on-one in the Oval Office with Mika than I have with Donald Trump. Now, that doesn't mean I'm Barack Obama's friend.
Right.
I'm Donald Trump's friend. And listen, he's been a good guy. When we've needed help with charities, he, Donnie Deutsch, a lot of these New York guys, Bloomberg, will be the first to call up. Well, a lot of Morning Joe people call him up. He gave $100,000 to David Axelrod's charity, Cure. So,
but he's also the other thing.
In that respect, I'm not trying to pull back and say he's not my friend. He is. And you know what? When we've asked him for help, he's helped us. And actually, he's been a really good guy. Donald Trump is actually, when nobody's looking, he's a good guy. At least he has been to us and the people that know him in this small community.
But beyond the friendship, you guys have a symbiotic, you know, everybody who deals with him in a television context has a symbiotic relationship with him.
Right.
He brings something that nobody else has ever been able to bring to this thing, which is immediate eyeballs when he's on.
Right.
Let's talk a little bit about the balancing act of asking him hard-hitting questions versus keeping him in the fold enough that he doesn't bolt and turn his back on you.
Right.
Is it a concern of yours
No.
that if you hit him too hard
No.
that he's...
Never has been. You know, we had CNN for a while was trying to say, hey, Joe and Mika went up and saw the New Hampshire returns. With it's a lie. Dana Bash saw us walking downstairs. She was furiously looking around, trying to figure out where Trump was. We actually went around the corner, so she assumed that we were going to see Trump. We sat and talked to Corey for about 30 minutes right. about the New Hampshire. Hey, what happened? How did this happen? Right. Corey and Hope and a couple other people were in the room. And then at the end, he said, hey, you want to go up and see the boss? I go, sure. And so we went up, shook hands with him for about 3 or 4 minutes. Then the family all poured in, and we knew it was our time to exit, so we left. So that's about it. But, you know, we've always been really blunt with Donald. So when CNN was hammering us, we actually saw Jazz Shaw put together a clip of Anderson Cooper's town hall meeting and our town hall meeting where it was so horrible that I asked, you know, the question asked Donald in the break, hey, so have you golfed lately? Anderson asked that question on air.
Right.
Along with, do you ever go to McDonald's? What do you eat when you go to McDonald's? Like we're talking about, you know, 40% tariffs and all that. I'm not knocking Anderson. I love when you actually delve into somebody's, you know, personal life and try to figure out what do they like, what music do they like. That's all legitimate.
I don't want you to chuck me out in the plaza. There was a hot mic moment in which there was the appearance, at least, that questions were being not vetted.
Oh, no, that's just not true.
That's bullshit. Explain that to me.
No, it's total bullshit. And I think if you've read it, you know it is.
Okay.
I mean, Mika was talking to the producers. Mika wanted to ask a question about, I'm trying to remember what it was.
Okay. I think it was on deportation.
On deportation. Mika was obsessed about the deportation police, right. which she had asked the question first. And Trump said, yeah, we'll have deportation police. So that made news. Mika wanted to follow up. She was talking to the control room. And if you listen to it, it's clear. She's talking to the control room. Okay. She goes, so do we go to the deportation thing? Trump is talking to me going, we don't ask any tough questions. They're only tough questions. And they said, no, go to the audience.
Right.
And Mika said, oh, okay. Okay. So no. And then she said the audience or something like that. So no. I mean, anybody that listens to that tape knows that. They also know that back in, you know, 6, 7, 8 months ago, when Trump talked about his Muslim ban, I said, is this what Nazi Germany looked like in 1933? They also know that, you know, we skewered him when he pretended like he didn't know who David Duke was. I also hung up on the guy. So, no, I ask anybody, I challenge anybody to find Trump on any shows. And there's a reason he hasn't been on lately.
Right.
It's because he knows. We got hammered because Meek and I were two of the only people that said, you guys are underestimating him. He could win the nomination. But we were asking tough questions all along.
Would you ask him, if you were in a situation where you asked him something, would you ask him a question knowing full well that it would cease the relationship, that he wouldn't go on, that he wouldn't come on any longer? Would you willfully ask him a question?
Yeah. Oh, of course I would. Yeah. I mean, the thing is, though, there is always a balancing act. I mean, I could have Hillary come on when Hillary comes on. And I could sit there and say, okay, so Hillary, why did you lie about the State Department signing off on this?
Right.
Hillary, but you lied, Hillary. Hillary, why did you? I could do that 5 or 6 or 7 times. Or I could ask her a question, have her get a response, push her once or twice, and then move on to what my audience wants to hear.
Hey, and I'm doing the same thing with you. Like if I've got about 4.5 minutes to ask you this before you get really pissed off.
No, but you understand my point. It is a balancing act.
No, you want people to say things.
But the thing is, I learned early on this show, and I actually learned it from my experience with Hillary.
Yeah.
You know, if I get Hillary on, and I'd have newsbusters and all the right wing sites.
Right.
Kicking my ass saying, well, gee, why weren't you tougher on Hillary? Why didn't you ask her about, you know, cattle futures?
Right.
And I'm like, give me a break. We're in 2008. I can ask those questions. I suppose at some point cattle futures will come up because Trump will bring cattle futures up, blah, blah, blah. But people want to hear Hillary talk.
Exactly. I agree.
And so in 2008, what I found was when I talked to Hillary without trying to play gotcha, we had amazing conversations. People started joking that she was my girlfriend because we had such... Her staff started putting her on our show first because she was so relaxed.
But there is that balancing act that you got to have in your head, right?
But there's also, though, what am I going to say to you when you come to, and sit at my table, like, for breakfast?
Right.
It's kind of like the thing that we have. We will push. We don't let people lie. We don't let people read their talking points. We cut them off, but it's a balancing act. Do I want to hammer Hillary for 30 minutes on email to know she's never going to come back? Do I want to hammer Ted Cruz on the shutdown and just how stupid he was for 30 minutes and never have him come back? Do I want to hammer, you know, it's always a balancing act. But if there's something out there, a lot of times I'll have reporters say, hey, the next time Trump comes on, can you ask this question? I'm like, sure. I'll ask him any question. Am I gonna make it about me? No. I always use the Barbara Walters, and you're probably too young for this, but I always use the Barbara Walters Richard Pryor interview. Richard Pryor had just been burned.
I remember.
By freebasing. I wanted to hear about Richard Pryor. I had to hear more about Barbara Walters than Richard Pryor.
Right.
And I always remembered that. It's about Richard Pryor.
You used...
It's about Donald Trump. It's about Hillary Clinton. It's about... By the way, look at the Bernie interviews.
Right.
Nobody ever attacks me for what I say about Bernie. I let Bernie talk for 40 minutes. And I try to find the things I agree with Bernie on, which is I think the banks are too big. I think the bailout was a disgrace. The rich are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer. The middle class is getting gutted out. I agree with him on that stuff. We can talk about that stuff. But if Bernie were on tomorrow, I'd say, Bernie, if you don't win California, you got to get out of this thing, right?
You said something, you used a word, the word lie, right? I think we're getting, as reporters all across the board here in this election,
right,
we're getting more comfortable using that word.
I'm not.
To describe people. But hold on, yeah. let me finish.
No.
So you got two candidates in Trump, whether you call it lying, dissembling,
right,
shading fact,
right,
incorrect assertions, however the hell you want to describe it. You have two candidates here who have had a demonstrable record of not necessarily telling the truth.
Right.
Let's just look at them comparatively. Both of their trust numbers are not good.
Horrible.
If you look at Trump on PolitiFact, he's off the chart. Ben Carson, I mean, they literally have to get a second screen.
It's crazy, yeah.
Hillary, better. Do you think, now Hillary's stock and trade, the reason why a lot of people, I will go out and I will talk to people, you go to a Sanders rally, Hillary lies. You talk to everybody, mm-hmm, relatives, mm-hmm, Hillary lies.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think, compare those two in terms of truthiness, who is a more truthful candidate and who do you think lies, dissembles more, Trump or Hillary?
Well, I think with Hillary, she starts, and she's moored. She has a set of beliefs. She has a 40-year history in the business. It's much easier to nail her down.
Right.
I think Trump is unmoored by any ideology, by any truth, and so he's just sort of, he's like a floating dock. It just sort of goes wherever it goes. And he's like Bill Clinton. I remember being on the Government Reform and Oversight Committee. You know, Bernie Nussbaum would come up and they would lie to us every day. And they lied so bad, everybody in the audience would laugh.
Right.
Because we'd be like, we know you're lying. Like, you should not be lying under oath. This is a bad thing. And I learned something from that. And that was that if you tell enough lies at a rapid enough pace, pretty soon people just get numb to it.
Well, there's a 20th century concept, and I don't want to sort of point out who said it, called the big lie.
Yeah, the big. And so you get to the 21st century. Donald Trump, he's on the show the other day, and he's talking about how horrible Hillary was with supporting the invasion of Libya. You know, 2 minutes afterwards, people are sending me this clip from Donald Trump in 2011 where he was all for the invasion of Libya. I don't know how people do that. I don't.
You mean Trump?
Yeah.
You don't know how
Trump does
it.
I don't know how Trump does that.
Is he lying or is he just telling or is he a bullshit artist?
I think Donald Trump believes a lot of what Donald Trump says, which is, is frightening in some aspects. With Hillary Clinton, you know, the latest State Department, the IG report, it's so obvious what Hillary Clinton should have said. But she continued saying things that just were not true. And that also shocks me. And I just sit there going, why doesn't somebody tell her to step up to the microphone and say, I've read the IG report. I'm troubled by its conclusions. I'm very sorry.
Tell me about it, man.
I made a terrible mistake, and I want to apologize to the American people, and I promise you I will never do it again.
Well, here's the thing. Trump, as we used to say this about Ed Koch when I covered City Hall, Ed Koch was unavoidable for comment, right?
Yeah.
Same thing with Trump. So Trump will come out there and talk. A couple of days ago, he had two press availabilities all over the place.
Right.
With her on the IG report, she pooled with an embed.
Right.
Which gave the whether she was lying or not, it gave the impression that she had something to hide. Trump could be saying 27 demonstrably false things, but he's out there saying it in his own voice, and so, look like he's running away.
And what's going to happen? I mean, are there going to be 27 stories the next day about the 27 lies that Trump told? Or are they just going to be, God, that's just what he does. You can't. It's hard to keep up with him. With Hillary, I guess it's a little easier to nail down. But
yeah, so who do you think, again, back to my original question, comparatively, do you think Trump is worse on the truth than Hillary?
I think they're different, and I think you know, Donald Trump lies about his steaks being the greatest selling steaks of all time. Trump lies about positions that he's taken in the past that he's never taken in the past. I think with Hillary, I think there aren't.
How about his income? How about something as core as his income?
Yeah, I mean, we don't know what his income is, right? Everybody in Manhattan will tell you in the financial business that it's much less than he says it is.
Forbes, Bloomberg.
With Hillary, though, I mean, the problem is that if she's not telling the truth, we're talking about national security. So there may be less, I don't even like to say lies, as the Soviets used to say, deliberate untruths.
Right.
There may be less deliberate untruths, but the gravity of them are much greater because you're talking about national security and was she reckless with national security? Was she reckless with classified documents?
Who do you personally trust more, her or him? I know you have a predilection, obviously, for Republicans.
Give me an example.
When she is giving
you... are you saying, who would I trust? Okay, go ahead.
Let's talk about sort of a comprehensive immigration reform. Clearly a huge point of differentiation between the two of them. She supports a pretty conventional democratic path to citizenship. You know, the executive orders, and he's talking about a wall.
I think at the end of the day, Trump would. Here's the thing you need to know about Trump.
Yeah,
I say he's on board. Actually, he's got a North Star, and that is the deal. He really is all about making deals.
Right.
And because he's not a Republican, he's not a Democrat, he's not a liberal, he's not a conservative. He's got these sort of gut nativist beliefs. But I think at the end of the day, he is the Archie Bunker billionaire. At the end of the day, I think Trump probably would have a better shot, believe it or not, of negotiating a comprehensive immigration reform package that could pass both chambers
in a Nixon and China sort of way.
In a Nixon and China sort of way, and also just in a Nixon sort of way. A guy who is a Republican, he was supposed to be a conservative, he started the EPA, he was about as progressive on domestic policy as
liberal,
anybody.
He'd be a moderate liberal Democrat.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
A couple more quick questions. Thanks again for taking the time.
No, we got time.
So in terms of the, let's just talk about the media business. There's been a lot of criticism on cable. CNN's taken, I think, some lumps.
Taking the hits, yeah. And by the way, there's another thing about Trump. And this is when I started to say this guy is not going to up his game. Saturday afternoon, maybe a week or two ago, he starts attacking CNN, tweeting on a segment on Saturday afternoon against the network that has turned over their airwaves to Donald Trump.
The whole business of
for him to be upset and use his time on a Saturday afternoon tweeting, attacking a network that has basically turned their entire broadcast center over.
And when
over
you
him,
say turned it over, you're talking about
the
plane on the tarmac, the empty podium.
Yeah, and he's on CNN.
Have you talked to Zucker about any of this stuff? Do you ever run into him?
No, but he and Zucker are very close. Zucker personally calls Trump. And
I didn't know that.
Books Trump.
Really?
And Trump laughs and calls Zucker my personal booker because Zucker will call Trump.
Has he said that publicly?
No, he hasn't said that publicly, but he said it. I've said it publicly now. But, you know, Trump will laugh every time Zucker calls because Zucker will call to personally book him.
Wow.
And so
how important is Trump to CNN's business model right now, you think?
I don't know. I know. And we weren't last year, but I know we haven't had Trump on that much, and we're beating him every day.
So you don't think Trump is fundamental to your business model at this point? He helps, right?
Listen, here's the deal.
Yeah, yeah.
Donald, and this is something that makes Donald Trump very angry. You talk about how you get to Donald Trump?
Yep.
I made the mistake in Donald Trump's eyes of saying that actually Chris Christie, at times when we'd have Trump on, and then Chris Christie on later in the week, Chris Christie would outrate Donald Trump. Bernie Sanders would outrate Donald Trump. You want to get to Donald Trump, that's how you do it. Yeah, I got a long letter. talking about spreadsheets and how he actually outrated Chris Creek. I just
An email or an actual letter?
Email. So what we noticed, though, was that, and we just kind of check, how did Trump do yesterday? I think after June, July, August, people knew the story.
Right.
So did people flock when Donald Trump came on? Maybe they still do in prime time. I don't know. But they didn't, at least for our show, because we've got a liberal, moderate.
You think people are building mix. Up like antibiotic resistance?
I know. I just we just didn't see the pop. That so the novel. So I don't know if the novel. So what I'm saying though is, so there you've got the micro. Donald Trump on air.
Right.
What impact does it have?
Right.
Well, it's not as big of an impact as you would expect. The macro impact of Donald Trump on the entire, like the habitat, on the ecosystem, does up everybody's numbers. Certainly, he's upped our numbers, and Bernie has too. I mean, Bernie's been huge for us. I think one of the reasons we're rating so well is because we actually gave Trump credit before anybody else did, and we also gave Bernie credit.
Well, one of the things I think it's interesting about your interviews with him, I saw a recent foreign policy interview you did with him.
With Bernie or Trump?
No, with Trump. And what was really interesting about it is you were providing the infrastructure for the conversation. Right. So he was saying China this, Japan this, that, and you were providing.
I wanted to nail him down. Yeah.
Well, no, you were providing content. You were providing actual, you know, granular content policy.
Because he always comes on and says the same thing.
Right.
So you have to drive him and say, okay, I want to know this. I want to Syria. What would you do with Syria?
His Syria answer was incomprehensible.
Right. And so then I had to say, okay, so would you, I said, we need to know, would you be for keeping Assad in power or not? Because that's the big divide right
now.
And I think he ended up saying yes, he would.
Or something.
And then we went to Libya. Would you be for, was it? And you have to do that because he speaks in such generalities.
So he says we're going to go
you
get
have
ISIS.
To nail him down.
He says we're going to go get ISIS.
Right.
But we're not going to go into Syria. And we're not going to go into Iraq.
Right.
And we're not going to go into Libya. Let me ask you, Joe, how the hell you get ISIS if you don't do any of those
things? I did get him to say at one point before, and I don't know if it changed his mind on this or not, that, you know, I did the same thing of boots on the ground. Would you put boots on the ground? Well, I don't know. How many would you put on? Would you put 10,000? You go, yeah, I'd put 10,000. Okay. Thank you so much, Mr. President.
Is that how we're going to do this?
Yeah. I think at the end of the day, though, he wants to speak in general. You know, listen, Donald knows exactly what he's doing.
Right.
He's going to speak in generalities as much as he can speak in generalities. And like Ronald Reagan, the greatest gift the world has given Donald Trump all along is underestimating him.
But he's not Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan had James Baker.
Right. No, he's not. I said, though, but in one respect, being underestimated was Ronald Reagan's, you know, the greatest gift the world gave to Ronald Reagan. It's the same thing with Donald Trump. That
Reagan
said,
was a governor. Dude, Reagan was a governor.
I know he was, but everybody mocked Reagan. When he was running in 1980, the fascist gun in the West, and, you know, B-list actor. I mean, just everybody, you know, bedtime for Bozo. But no, I mean, Trump is no Reagan. There's no doubt about that. He is underestimated, though. That said, I think demographics and I think an electoral map that's always stacked against Republicans, I think his lack of campaign infrastructure actually dooms him for the fall. Unless, you know, I said it a month ago and they've done absolutely nothing. A month ago, he said they have to make the turn fast. This is a battleship. They've got to turn it around. They've got about a month to turn it around with Hispanic voters, with women voters. They just haven't done it.
Well, they're very lucky Hillary has such an abysmal 3 weeks.
She's had a rough,
And the Bernie thing is just going to, I mean, he is getting more and more bellicose.
He is. I do think California actually is extraordinarily important because if Bernie loses by double digits, then he's out. If Bernie were to win California, which I don't, again, we're talking about demographics. Yeah. At the end of the day, it's about demographics. And you look at Bernie. Bernie has not won a state where that has been more diverse than the national average.
Right.
I don't think Hillary's won a state that has been less diverse than the national average. California's extraordinarily diverse. I don't see how Bernie wins California. If Bernie were to win California, though, Then I think you're looking at, you know, the possibility of Bernie as a VP. But I just don't think that'll happen, because at the end of the day, I've said it for 25 years, demographics is destiny. Whether you're talking about Medicare, whether you're talking about Social Security, whether you're talking about the electoral map, whether you're talking about who wins in the general election.
I will say I agree with, I guess it was Heilman said this a couple of days ago on Elizabeth Warren. As recently as 2-3 weeks ago, the Clinton people were telling me that there was no chance in hell it was going to be Warren.
I just, yeah.
I think there is a, look, there's a bridge between Warren and the, there's a bridge between Warren and the Clintons, and that's Mandy Grunwald.
Yeah.
And isn't Warren a way to sort of cut out Bernie's legs from under him?
I think she'd be a very dangerous pick. And I think she'd be a dangerous pick because I think, again, talking about friends, I like Elizabeth Warren. I know her. I like her. I don't think she's ready to run for vice president. I mean, everybody has propped her up to be this political superstar. I remember interviewing her saying that she was, you know, that turning to Mika going, she's amazing, because she was. You know, she's got that Oklahoma accent, a Harvard professor, great mix of everything.
A great candidate in Massachusetts.
But people forget she had deer in the headlight look in her eyes, Massachusetts. I remember them always rushing her out of events and trying to push her in the car. If you can't handle the Boston Herald, you can't handle being like,
I had to sit down with her for a profile that I did, and I've never had this before. You know, like I'm stealing time from you now. They literally had someone with a stopwatch. They said they were going to give me 18 minutes, and at 18 minutes, she was in mid-sentence. Her staffer stood up and shut it down.
Holy cow.
I have never seen anything like that.
Well, you know, the thing is also, I think what you have with Elizabeth Warren is you have somebody who's very eloquent on the issue that's important to her, but I think would have a New York Daily News like sort of situation with her. If you started asking her about Syria and you started talking about the Sunnis and the Shia and then talk about Turkey, well, what do you do about the Kurds and how do you split it up? And then you talk about, you know.
She didn't care that much about that stuff.
Well, she doesn't. And I just don't know that we wouldn't have, again, the same thing that we had with Bernie in his New York Daily News interview. That's why I actually think Bernie would be a safer choice than Elizabeth Warren.
Last question, and it kind of pertains to, I think, the new journalism. If you're going to talk about the direction print is going in, or whatever the hell it is that I work for, I think real-time fact-checking is going to become a permanent feature of our business.
Right.
Because you have, and I think that is one way that Trump can positively, I think, impact journalism. Now, for instance, I'm not taking this out of your hide today, everybody did it. You know his remarks about about healthcare being better for illegal immigrants than it is for the VA, right?
Right.
Which is demonstrably not true.
Yeah, not true.
Not true at all. Because he says so much stuff, you know, you guys ran a chyron on that. You said that, and then you moved on to your next topic. There's plenty of critical material on Trump in your show. Don't you think at some point in time, and I'm sort of an advocate for this position, that a crawler where you have someone on staff.
I think it's a great idea.
That you just fact-check in real time.
I will tell you because, like, for instance, you know, this morning. So if we ran that this morning,
yeah.
I was, like, looking down at my next interview or eating my croissant or whatever we eat on the. So I didn't see that personally. Usually, so sometimes we'll hear something, we'll look up, and then we'll laugh and go, well, that's not true. But I think that's actually a great idea to have. In fact, I'm going to steal it. Don't tell anybody else.
Take it.
And to have a real-time fact checker.
You know, and the other thing.
I think that's a great idea, especially with, like, for instance, Hillary's response to the IG report would have been great. When Hillary said, you know, as I said all along, the State Department approved it, you know, and then somebody false, and then da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Because they know what tape we're going to run.
Yeah.
Then you know, and Trump saying, Hillary made a terrible mistake going into Libya. I would have never done that. False. And da-da-da,
exactly.
You know, and
you
take that off.
And the other thing about it is—
That's a great idea, especially with these two candidates.
Like when Hillary came out Brian Fallon came out with his statement on the IG report where he said, it proves that she was following a pattern of other secretaries. I tweeted out immediately, no, that's not true. The report says she went considerably beyond anything that Colin Powell ever did.
Right.
So there's a fundamental factual difference. I think the future of our business is doing that stuff in real time.
You do it in real time. I think the problem, though, is that because people are so overwhelmed by so many sources of news, I think that allows Trump to get away with what Trump gets away with. If you had ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and you know the Wall Street Journal, like we had back in you know pre 1990.
When there was a coherence to the narrative.
There's a coherence to the narrative. Every network at the top of you know top of six would be saying, today Donald Trump said da da da. It's not true. Then they'd run the package. Today Hillary Clinton claimed that what she'd been doing was considered, and then they'd run the package. But now, and it's been one of my great complaints, people can find the news wherever they want the news. They can find the truth wherever they find the truth. And I get bombarded from friends and relatives with just the most outrageous things. You know, how could it be that people are doing this to Trump? When, and I just, it's not true.
Yeah.
Not happening. You know, my mother would even do that back when I was in Congress. You know, I don't know if you ever got this sheet. It was amazing. You know, did you know that half of the members of Congress have filed for bankruptcy at least three times? You know, 17% have felony. I mean, all of these outrageous things. And I'd be like, you know, email like, Mom, for the 14th time, this is just not true. It didn't matter. So I do think it's a real
challenge. It's a huge frustration.
It's a huge frustration. It's a real challenge. And the question is, what form do you do that resonates?
I think the thing is you got to do it as a collective to create a collective in the way that the Associated Press was a collective.
You know, what would be a great idea is if you got a group of publications together that that did that, kind of like they did after the 2000 election, where they counted all the ballots.
That's a great point, yeah.
But boy, there would have to be a really tight standard to it, because there are a lot of, I have seen some fact-checking operations
and
that
some
need
of them,
fact-checking.
Well, but that's the thing, then they get attacked.
Because they will come at it from their own point of view and what is true or false to them. Like, objectively, if you stick with the objective facts, Donald Trump attacks Hillary Clinton for invading, for supporting the invasion of Libya. Did Donald Trump? Yes, and you have the quote.
Right.
I think that would be a great service. Right. And as long as you didn't take the sort of jumps that sometimes PolitiFact and others take, I think that would be a great service.
Or you
service.
Could do what the fake Fox and Friends crawl does it on Saturday Night Live, where they do, have you seen that, where they do all the corrections? It's like,
Yeah. That would be good.
NAFTA was not a porn star. well, Joe, thanks for taking the time. This was a blast.
Yeah, I loved it. Thanks. Any other questions? Any like music questions? Any?
What do you listen to?
Actually, right now I'm playing an awful lot. So I'm recording and playing and to kind of have the headphones all the time listening and remixing some stuff.
Now, you started off being like a Sex Pistols guy, right? In high school?
I started off listening to... Actually, the first album I got my hands on, and this shows you how old I was. Like, my mom went to the library, and I actually went to, they had records at this library, and I got Endless Summer by the Beach Boys.
Really?
And I sat and listened to that for about 4 weeks, and didn't turn it back in time. But then I stumbled into the Beatles, and was a massive Beatles fan, and it was Beatles, Kinks, Who, Rolling Stones. But then by college, it was huge Elvis Costello fan, Sex Pistols, and the Clash.
I grew up on, I grew up in New York in the 1980s, and it was all, I grew up in Southern Brooklyn, nowhere, man. I'm not talking cool Brooklyn, I'm talking Bernie Sanders. My mother went to high school with Bernie Sanders.
Oh, okay.
Madison High School.
Yeah.
Metal was all it was. Anthrax.
Wow.
There was a band called Carnivore, which became Typo Negative. Yeah. But we were, my group of friends and I, we were Motorhead.
That's amazing.
Freaks.
That's amazing. Now, I'm from a different block. I was Deep South, University of Alabama. I was there when R.E.M. sort of burst on
out of Athens.
Scene. Yeah, out of Athens, and so yeah, a lot of R.E.M. as well.
You were in Tuscaloosa. My first job was with the Birmingham Post Herald.
Was it really?
You got it. I spent a lot of time in Dreamland in Tuscaloosa.
That's I ate an unhealthy amount of ribs and white bread.
Well, that's why I had a heart attack. Okay. All right, dude.
All right.
Great talking.
Thanks
to you.
A lot.
Appreciate it.